The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
This practice, this form of training, is rooted in the ancient practice of encounters between teacher and student, and particularly within the Zen tradition, where those encounters, as we see in the records, the koans, were not to impart knowledge or information, but rather to awaken the mind. So in Zen we speak of live words, words that don't explain or define, but rather enliven, dislodge, collapse structures of thought, of concepts, of views. And so Dharma encounter is one of the forms of training and teaching. We have Mondo, which is more of a discussion that is generally more conceptual. We have Taisho, which I usually do on Sundays, which is just a formal presentation of the Dharma. We have informal conversations, Doksan, Daisan, face-to-face teaching, and Dharma encounter. And the benefit of this is that it is live, it's spontaneous, it puts the student right on the spot. In a sense, it puts the teacher on the spot as well. Because I don't know what you're going to ask, and you don't know what I'm going to say next in terms of the subject. And so it makes it very alive. And that's an important part of training. You know, life shows up unexpectedly. Moments appear and pass quickly. And sometimes we lose opportunities to respond, to meet them. And so this is a way of developing our capacity to just step forward, to, in a sense, go public. You know, we're always pretty public. But now we know it. And to benefit from each other's questions and responses. And because face-to-face teaching is always done privately, you never know what's going on in there, except when you go. And so what I wanted to focus on this morning, we're studying karma, this ango, and to keep in mind that the Buddha said that there's three essential aspects to training. In other words, that when we train, when we practice Buddha Dharma, there are three things, three aspects that really we're trying to cultivate. Sometimes all together, sometimes more singularly. But all of these are to be developed within us and between us as we develop ourselves in the practice. The first is the Shila, we can think of it as the precepts, it's compassion. It is learning how to cease from creating harm, to how to let go of all of the creation of all that creates bondage and suffering and unhappiness in our lives and the lives of others. There's the cultivation of samadhi, our concentration and mindfulness, calming the winds of the restless mind and body, and the afflictive emotions, the kleshas, which are sort of our deepest dispositions. They're the basis of our reactivity, of our biases. And prajna, wisdom, clear seeing. Each of these has its own transformative effect. Each of these affects our lives in different ways, and to some degrees deeply, but only prajna, the Buddha taught, insight, pulls up the roots. And in a sense, is the realization of the unconditioned, When we practice the precepts, when we develop samadhi, those are transformative, but it's also based on what we are doing, on the karma we're creating. When we realize prajna, that is not the result, in a sense, in that moment, it is not a karmic experience, right? But it is beyond thought and idea. And so keeping that in mind, in the book that we're reading by Kabgon, Trelek Kabgon, and I'm going to paraphrase this, because he framed it in a certain way, and so I'm going to respectfully take the liberty of reframing this a little bit. If we're really pursuing insight, developing our understanding, realizing our self-nature, in a purely, purely from the perspective of wanting to realize wisdom, if that's really sort of how we're seeing it, just realizing wisdom, then we can easily become overly introverted. We can think of it as a very solitary practice because we're imagining ourselves going inside, going deep down into our zazen, into our samadhi. The external world and other people and other living beings can then become a distraction. And giving them attention can become annoying and irritating. We can see that as taking away from our meditation, taking us away from our concentration, distracting us, being an interruption. Because we are looking to unravel the knotty issues of our life, of our suffering, of our desire to be free, and we need that time for ourselves on the cushion, developing our samadhi and realizing wisdom, we can kind of close off. And so he says, Buddhism regards this kind of insight gained in this way to be inferior. It's not the bodhisattva path. Prajna, in this sense, is very much cultivated and developed and brought forth and deepened when we become more caring and more loving and extend ourselves more to others, when we actually practice the bodhisattva vows. Then we will not be as closed-minded, right, if we take this more non-dual approach. To this end, the Buddha taught the meditation that we think of as and speak of as loving-kindness. And so to really bear in mind that these are practices. When we do the four measurables in the morning, after morning zazen, this goes back to the Buddha. It's an ancient practice. It's a meditation. It's a cultivation practice. And a generation practice, you could think of in that way. The Buddha said that loving kindness was crucial for the development of insight and wisdom, which he said was crucial for our fundamental freedom and liberation. In Buddhism, there's no strict separation of the cognitive aspect of our mind, our knowing, our thoughts and concepts, and our emotional and affective aspect. We could also think of this as there's no inherent separation between wisdom and compassion. Our cognitive ability should be supported by the richness of our emotional repertoire, our emotional resources. And by emotional, I would understand him to mean all that we experience as sensation. Sensation, emotion, everything that we feel, right? That we feel as a feeling thing, as a sensory experience, particularly within ourselves. It says, in other words, if we're emotionally barren or dried up, then even our cognitive ability will be compromised. Its effectiveness reduced. This is why the meditation of loving kindness is said to help us not only to see more clearly, but to think more clearly. Then he says, everything we do in order to gain proper insight produces good karma. We need to be aware on a number of fronts. Then we need to make sure that our body is healthy, relatively healthy, that we are practicing bringing forth joy and happiness, practicing in a positive state, cultivating a affirmative, sort of positive association with practice. And then emotionally, at the level of feelings, we need to make sure that we're not rigid and closed up. Paying attention to such things produces good karma. It's the basis of producing good karma, which in turn leads to gaining insight. And the Buddha was really very clear and incredibly deeply insightful about this, about the relationship between the level of our internal state, you know, our level of stability and calmness, or the level of agitation, and how that directly enters into our meditation. And he says, insight arises from this good karma that we're creating and doing the types of things that overcome negative karma. Okay? So I wanted to ask a couple questions to present to you. So based in your understanding, and more importantly, in your own experience of practice, why is loving kindness, the practice of loving kindness, the cultivation of loving kindness, not just good in and of itself, but crucial for your development of insight, of awakening? Why is your cultivation of compassion actually essential to realizing wisdom? And then he says, insight arises from creating positive karma and doing the things that help to overcome or resolve or diminish our negative binding karma or suffering. So how do you understand that in relationship to practice and training? The Eightfold Path, the Eight Gates. In other words, what you call practice, what you do is practice and training that is helping you to cease from harm and actualize good for others. How is that helping you to bring forth prajna? Dadaroshi often said that wisdom without compassion is not true wisdom, and compassion without wisdom is not true compassion. How do you understand that? We speak of them as two aspects. The Buddha taught of them as two aspects, two of the three essential aspects. How do you understand that they are inseparable and indivisible, that we can't actually be cultivating compassion without wisdom and vice versa? And then how can you express this directly? Now, you know when you were in school and you had a test and then there was a bonus question that you got extra credit for? Well, this is not school, nor is this a test, nor will you get any extra credit. But having said all of that, Nagarjuna, the great Nagarjuna, said, whatever is dependently co-arisen, whatever arises in a codependent state, which is everything, the Buddha, that was the Buddha's realization, that nothing appears on its own, independently, autonomously. It all arises out of karma causes and conditions. Whatever is dependently co-arisen is understood, is seen to be emptiness. That being a dependent designation is itself the middle way. Nothing exists that is not dependently originated. Therefore, there is nothing that is not empty. It's a very, very important teaching of Nagarjuna's. It's often quoted. And Kelbgon says in his book, because of this, because everything is independently or interdependently arising, karma is also an interdependently arising phenomena, lacking inherent or intrinsic existence. Therefore, we can, he says, overcome it. And I said yesterday, I understand what he's saying, and I think you do too, but it's a little tricky because we can think of that as subduing, of dominating, or of even extinguishing, which is not what actually is happening. But to be free of it, to liberate it. And so how do we understand that statement of Nagarjuna is about everything that is a dependently arising is understood to be emptiness? Because everything is dependently arising, everything is empty, so too with karma. And because of this, we can actually practice and free ourselves. So how do you understand that? And how does practice and training both you work within that very understanding? How, in essence, is practice an expression, a manifestation of that very understanding that Nagarjuna is expressing, that is freeing ourselves of our binding karma? So those are the things I wanted to bring up. Now, the thing about this subject is that it can be very conceptual, right? There's a lot of Buddhist understanding that we need to develop and become familiar with to really understand Buddhism's teaching of karma. So the challenge here, given that this is a Dharma encounter and not a mando, is to try and really to to bring that less conceptual, more direct, experiential aspect out, okay? So you do your part of that, and I will do my part of that. Okay? So Chike, the chief disciple, will be the first to come up. She'll do three bows to begin. Everybody else who comes up can just do one bow. And I'd like to open this up and invite anyone who's participating formally in the Ango, and particularly those of you who might not have done Dharma Encounter before. This is a good opportunity to engage this particular form of training, to put yourself out there on the spot for the Sangha and for yourself. Okay, so we can go ahead and make a line here on the carpet. And the time is now.
So, Shan Chi. In practicing an understanding of my own karma and how it has led me to practice and the cultivation of my practice, we chant in the Sutra of Great Compassion, related to all Buddhas in cause and effect. Mm-hmm. So does something in between those, is my practice and the cultivation of wisdom and the way you spoke about it, about me trying to understand what that is, you know, my identification with all Buddhas, because my karma limits, you know, puts essentially blinders a little bit on my view of the world. And so practice enlarging my view and understanding how I'm related to all Buddhas in cause and effect. Is that what I'm supposed to be trying to figure out?
In Open Sozan this morning, at the end, before we lifted our silence, at the end of the session, you spoke about you invoked the ancestors. When you invoke the ancestors, what is that? What is happening? Not the idea of it, but what is happening in you?
The ancestors ground my existence. They help me, like when I sit in Zazen and I feel my butt on the cushion and my feet on the floor, I feel alive. I feel connected.
But what does that have to do with the ancestors?
I'm connected, I'm related to them, I'm part of them.
How? What is that relation?
They gave birth to me. Their path, their journey, and the gift of this Dharma that has perpetuated all of this time is a gift that is constantly available to me.
How will you repay that? How will you repay them?
In service, in trying to combust my life in a way that is consistent with this practice.
How can you say that more directly? How do you repay?
By meeting people and sentient and insentient objects and traveling my path in the most alive way I can.
And when you're doing that, right, and you're not sitting here talking about it, How is it at that moment?
There's no separation. They're me. I'm them. I don't judge. I don't make assumptions about who they are, what they're saying, where they're coming from. They could be me. They are me. So I try and meet them in that way.
Okay. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So while Chisho is coming up, I just want to reiterate the points, just because I threw a lot at you this morning. So why is loving kindness crucial? Why is the cultivation of compassion crucial for our awakening of insight? How do we understand our practice, the Eightfold Gate, the Eightfold Path, the Eight Gates, the life that we're living in practice, as a way to be bringing forth that insight through the, is it the diminishment of our karma, our negative karma? Or is the realization of our karma? Are those different? And why did Daroshi say wisdom? And this is not original with him by any means, but he said it so often. And it's a way to bring him into the room. Why did he often say that wisdom without compassion, compassion without wisdom are not complete?
Question.
Why is loving kindness, the cultivation of compassion, essential for the awakening of the mind, to prajna, to realizing self nature?
So, practicing loving kindness helps me see other people as myself, as no different from myself, or other beings that we're essentially the same, with the same desires and wish to be happy.
Well, that is true, but at the same time, here I am sitting facing you, right?
Right.
After lunch, your home is somewhere else, my home is here, we are different.
Right.
So how are we the same? What is that sameness that you speak of?
All I know is that when I see someone else's pain or joy and join in it without, because I recognize that it's a similar experience to what I have, that my sense of self dissolves mm-hmm. somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, it's a relief.
Mm-hmm.
For me,
mm-hmm.
But it also brings me closer to mm-hmm. that person
mm-hmm.
that I can often really set apart as other.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting if we think of it as a path, which it is, but also a path of our experience. So we might be in the presence of someone who is suffering and not feel anything. We might be in their presence and have sympathy. I'm sorry that this is happening for you, but I'm. It doesn't really invoke any particular response in me. There is empathy, in which I see your suffering and I experience some pain. It's not your pain, but it is. There's a kind of those mirror neurons that we read about, and so. But when that goes further, right, because there's still you and me, right, you're actually experiencing the suffering. I am for the moment, right, but it will pass. It might pass when you walk away. But how does selflessness transform that? If you think of the metaphor as the waves on the ocean, right, the ocean is prajna. The waves is where we practice compassion. Right, and you look over and you see another wave. Right, you're in your prime. It's already almost ready to hit the beach. Right, almost at the end. Right, how does recognizing that you are nothing but ocean change things? How does that serve you? How does that serve the other?
A recognition that waves arise and they fall away.
Mm-hmm. And so too you.
Right.
Okay.
So too this suffering or that joy or this life or that life.
Right.
That it's a momentary manifestation.
Right.
That passes.
Yeah, that in really meeting impermanence, we are in the company of every living thing.
Yeah.
Good company. But to reflect on that, you know, to use that metaphor, because it's very powerful. You know, and some metaphors are more or less sort of meet, you know, the meaning of what they're pointing to. And that metaphor has its weaknesses, but it can be quite powerful to contemplate, how is there individuality? How is it that you and I are facing the same thing and that there is nothing but ocean? May your life go well.
Thank you.
One way of looking at that is to see how, when we are not aware of that, when we see the waves as being very distinct, having nothing to do with each other, how is that? You know, Buddhism is a very evidence-based practice, and delusion is constantly giving us the evidence of how it works and doesn't.
I think about how one can have a understanding of the universe on a scientific level or philosophical level and realize that it's all emptiness. Compassion isn't needed to realize that. And without compassion, I mean, that understanding in and of itself doesn't lead to any understanding of, I guess, without compassion, it's easier to say everything is meaningless. But with compassion, which enters on some different level of our psyche, then things do have meaning and we all are connected.
But if you realize selflessness, if you realize that Jonathan is liberated from suffering, why isn't that enough? You're free. Why do you need to cultivate compassion? To realize that.
I think of compassion, well, in a way, we're fueled by emotions. We need compassion to want to do anything, or some motivating emotion.
So when you're sitting in a place of meaninglessness, what desire does that fulfill?
None.
Are you sure?
Sitting in a place of meaninglessness. There's an intellectual satisfaction to it. Maybe it makes me feel smart.
Is there any way in which it lets you off the hook?
Yes, that also.
Right, and are you actually off the hook?
No.
May your life go well. In a very real sense, that's Buddhism in a way is, you know, we each have to bring ourselves here. There's no coercion, there's no force, there's no evangelizing. But once we enter, it's quite demanding, right? And it's kind of extraordinary because at every moment we have to freely be stepping forward, right? Everyone is here by choice, and everyone chooses to be here in every moment, right? And that's so important. And yet being here, then we meet a demand, an imperative. Right? Because of exactly that. Because we, no matter what we do with our minds, no matter what clever views or perspectives we might have, and no matter how resolute we might be about them, right? We are bound together.
So, I can't resist falling into or maybe I shouldn't even bother worrying about resisting falling into the so-called good or bad karma. I think I remember.
What does it mean to not worry about it for you? When you say,
well, then
don't
I'm
worry
separating
about
myself from the other person. We're the same thing. So is that what you're driving at?
Well, but being the same thing, is that always being perfectly manifested?
No.
Okay. So then if you don't worry about it, do you have another way to remember? And I advocate another way to remember.
I think I have an idea of how you would advocate it. I mean, you would allow it to pierce your emotional, my emotional field.
What calls you forth in moments when, as Caliban says, you might find yourself retreating? What calls you forth?
Calls me forth.
I don't come know. Out, Choco, come out.
Yeah, because, who wants to be a wimp? And it's no fun being a wimp.
What does that mean, being a wimp?
No, you know, hiding, being afraid of everything. There's, what could there be?
It may not be fun, but what is the pleasure that it gives
pleasure?
Us? Why do we do it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you and I talk and you make suggestions on how I might live my life, you don't make suggestions, but I mean, you point at where I might do something differently. And then that really makes me uncomfortable, because then I know I really have to do that.
Well, but you don't, you see. You don't. I mean, there's a suggestions, not demands, right?
Yeah.
And the fact is no matter what is happening in that moment, whether you're feeling like, no, that's not going to happen, I'm not going to do that, or whether you feel invigorated and like, yes, and you feel resolute, that's that moment. And then you go home, as everyone does.
Yeah.
Session ends, right? And you return to your normal life. And then the question is, what happens then?
Oh.
Right? And so when he talks about retreating, you know, how we retreat, and that's just sort of a, it's like an occupational thing for us, right? Because it's a very interior practice. In one sense, we have to go inward, right? We have to see into the nature of this mind and these emotions and these sensations, and we have to actually realize we have a body, like for real, and all that means, right? And unify. And wake up what has become asleep and numb, right? And calm what is too excited and agitated. And all the while seeing, examining, penetratingly.
I sometimes experience fearfulness of my lack of knowing myself. Mm-hmm. That tomorrow at home, I'm likely to fall back. I'm not going to get up at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. I mean, I'm just not going to do it.
So how can you use that fear? So the fear arises.
Yeah.
How can you use it well?
Discomfort. So actually, it might make me get out of bed. It might make me get out of bed a little earlier. Is that what you're sort of... Well, let's use that as specific examples, because, I'm a stay up late, sleeping kind of guy, and when I get down, I can spend a lot of time down, you know.
Staying up later and sleeping.
Staying down, reading, yeah. Just, getting horizontal. In fact, family joke.
So here, you know, you do very well. You've been doing this for years and years. You do everything that we do. You get up early, you go to sleep early, right? You do the practices and you experience the benefit of that.
Yeah.
So remember, mindfulness has the quality, one aspect of it is remembering. Remembering. You know, it's a very incredible, it's amazing aspect of our consciousness, right? We can be experiencing something in this moment, like a tendency to want to stay up late, right? Want to not sit, right? And that's what we're actually feeling, uh-huh. right? And that's sort of moving us in a certain direction. And as a practitioner, we're developing this basis of mindfulness, right? And so maybe it's our vows that come into mind. Maybe we look up and see our altar, and that reminds us of something, because it's not just an artifact, right? It's not just a piece of furniture. It's a living thing that we have a relationship with, right? Because we're cultivating that all the time, right? Or maybe we remember how it is when we sit, how it is when we're in session, yeah. right? And that remembering, now we're invoking that experience, and it can become an affective experience. Right, that now is standing alongside or maybe even getting stronger than that other experience we're having that wants us to move in a way that's not going to be so helpful for us. You understand what I'm saying?
I think I do.
And so this is where practice is, we have to actually, on some level, and this is the hard part, it always comes back to you.
Yeah, don't
want it.
Yeah.
No one actually can come and save you. There's immense help and support. But in the end, we actually have to be the one that makes that choice. And then we have to learn how to be skillful to get to that point of making that choice. And we can use our experiences of the many moments when we don't make that good yeah. choice. And
well,
study.
You feel bad.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
You remember, you know, you can be happy.
And draw upon the actual experience. It's not an idea. You know what that feels like, right?
Yeah.
May your life go well.
Thank you.
Of course, that's one of the profound benefits of practicing together, is that when we are not in a certain state or not doing something that would be helpful, we can look up in almost any direction and see someone who is. And that's enormously helpful. When we're alone, by virtue of that, we have to draw upon, in a sense, we have to create that sense of community or create ways to bring that forth in our solitude.
So John.
Ancestors is a good way of doing that.
So John, say. It's always my mind that gets me in the line, and then by the time I try to find my heart. And so it's not unknown to you that a lot of my life has traveled grabbing for identity mm-hmm. and defending that mm-hmm. and traveling amongst people where that's really important mm-hmm. and to shore up their defenses against the world that wants to take their identity away, mm-hmm. that sees their identity as the object of their hatred. In my development, though, I have also gotten to the point where I can see my own pain in that grasping of my identity,
yeah.
and I need to let it go. Let it go. And in letting it go, it also means bringing down defenses, mm-hmm. being vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And the more I realize that I don't know, gender's empty. You know, I mean, just to go right to the bone, I mean, it's empty. There's nothing there. And yet, my life's been so defined around it.
Mm-hmm. When you speak of identity mm-hmm. for you, mm-hmm. what is that word pointing to?
Points to our separation.
No, but I mean the identity that you have needed to mm-hmm. take hold of and occupy and declare, I am here.
Yeah.
Right. What is the truth, the living embodiment that word is pointing to?
You see her before you.
Right. Exactly. And so when you let go of that, what remains? When you let go of the holding to the identity, what remains?
Love.
And this miracle of life. When we let go of the identity, the idea, what remains is the whole thing. May your life go well.
Thank you.
The whole person. You are not a thing.
Shusanji. Cultivating practice gives me a way to witness things more clearly as they arise by slowing down and getting into that space so that I can kind of see all the factors at play and try to remove myself from it. But removing myself from it isn't always helpful. I've said it before about, in Zazen more specifically, falling to the bottom of the ocean and being able to have a greater awareness.
But going back to removing yourself from it, when you do that, where are you then? Where have you removed yourself to?
I'm still there, but I'm more in the other person as well, or in the situation.
So what have you removed?
I've removed the ways that I cut myself off.
And what does it mean to remove a way that you cut yourself? What is actually happening in that moment?
Opening up more.
And when we open up more, what happens? You already know. Right? Right?
It seems that loving kindness is the only way it makes things bearable to watch all the things that you can't necessarily help with.
Hmm. Yeah. Speaking, I think it was with the students yesterday in the group, that were doing Sesshin at home. I think it was there. We were talking about compassion being, because these vows are so large, you know, they're so, to save all sentient beings, to liberate the suffering of all beings, right? And so if we understand that wrongly, it can undermine, it can really cripple us, actually. And so to understand as practitioners, as bodhisattvas with vows, what can we do? And what can't we do, right? Because we so come within all of our limitations and limit ourselves so often, the teachings are constantly trying to get us to release those limitations. And yet part of that, part of our wisdom is to recognize the limitations that exist within ourselves, within a situation, within another person, because otherwise we will generally become forceful, aggressive. And so that is essential. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So why is loving compassion so important for developing prajna and insight? Share some of my experience. Going back to a little bit about codependent inter-arising, in my experience, I've always been a very loving and compassionate person, luckily, for karma.
family, what have you. It was in combined with insight that it started to get to a different level. And so I think that we develop those together. Kind of chicken before the egg, right? Loving compassion or insight? I think it's both. They happen together, in my experience. And as we develop that insight, we realize the connectivity of everything.
Who are you talking about here?
Everyone.
You're speaking on behalf of everyone.
Yes.
Okay.
As we develop this insight, we realize that we are interconnected very intimately. Science even says this, right? We exhale carbon dioxide, trees absorb it, they produce oxygen. So I think that we cannot underestimate the impact of any one sentient being, any one act. And when we start to realize that, we develop a very deep, loving compassion.
So all that, having said all of that, is there any danger in seeing yourself as having been a loving person all your life?
Yes.
What?
Could be arrogance, ignorance. That could be one of them. I think there are, you know, you could think, I've already realized it. I don't have anything else to do, right? So I think it needs to be combined with humility. And obviously, we all grew up, right? I mean, I've had instances where I definitely wasn't loving and compassionate. Unfortunately.
I would really, you know, I think that's worth examining. You know, whenever we hear ourselves, and it's wonderful that you have been that person all this life. And however we frame ourselves to ourselves, right? Whenever we find ourselves thinking, I am, this is the kind of person I am, there's almost certainly truth in that, right? And there's more. And so from the point of view of the Prajnaparamita sutras speak about this in great detail. And so I would just encourage you, all of us, to really examine that, right? What is in that, right? Language is so powerful, you know. The verb to be, I am, right? And as practitioners, we may think we have a handle on that. Yeah, but, you know, the self is empty. But that language, we've been using it all our lives. And so, just to explore that, may your life go well.
Sir Sanchi, for most of my practice life, I looked at the cultivation of prajna as the key. And then one day I saw a particular episode where, not in this temple, where someone who had significant prajna wasn't functionally very compassionate. And then it hit me, mm-hmm. and it reflected back to me.
Mm-hmm.
My life changed.
In that moment, or in that process, did you see how not having cultivated compassion, that your own understanding was limited?
Very.
But why was it limiting that? Why not just realize the nature of mind?
Because I was missing something. I was missing you, and you, and you. And therefore missing me. And where that functionally has landed for me, as a practice, I can't say anything about whether it's realization, but as a practice, is everything I'm encountering is offering to me. It's, I don't own it. It's a gift. And I guess that's an understanding or realization of compassion. I don't know what that really means. But that's the basis of how I practice. And I know it's a practice because there are plenty of moments where that is not alive. But I'm willing to struggle in those moments. I'm willing to really, struggle means really look to see what is being offered and to take that as my own.
Yeah. To go back to the original intention, if we could only be as a beginner, Kazan said, who would not become a person of the way? You know, another way of looking at that, which is very something that everyone, I think, can hopefully appreciate, is that in our Zazen, if we think of Zazen as, you know, developing our concentration, and with that concentration, we're going to, you know, see into our self nature, into our original mind. But at every step along the way, we're encountering the self arising, thoughts, emotions, memories, right? The effects of our karma. And how we meet each of those things, if we're just focusing on our concentration, that, as Kelbkon said, all of those are just distractions, interruptions. And with the image I have is like of a bow of a ship, an icebreaker. And it's just plowing through, and all of that ice just breaks apart and moves aside, and the ship leaves it behind. And it looks from the bow like smooth sailing, right? But eventually you're going to hit some ice that doesn't yield, right? And so that at every step along the way, we need to be, we must be developing, practicing, bringing forth that compassion within ourselves, right? Otherwise that, you know, I've met people, I remember meeting somebody many years ago who came in for an introductory retreat, never been here before, and said they'd realized wisdom, right? And they were like, I mean, they were like a coiled wire, right? And, it, you know, it was a little bit like... And that was his attitude and approach. And meanwhile, he described the rest of his life as a train wreck. And there was no cognitive relationship in his mind. This had nothing to do with that.
It's something that really I try and pay attention to, which has that ship plowing through, which is kind of an aspect of my personality. You don't have to laugh. Is the mess I leave behind me. You know, those, the broken up. And that's what hurts.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it's unavoidable because we're human. I'm human. But the more attention I pay to that possibility, even when it's happening and it's unavoidable, somehow the more love there is. I can't put it in better words.
You know, it's so interesting, the nature of pain. And although, you know, you talked about Nenshin, there are people who are in chronic pain and pain that's, you know, can be very, very difficult, very debilitating. And yet, the nature of pain, because it hurts, what if it didn't? What then? You know, I injured my knee before Sesshin, and so I had some consultation from you, and I've been working on it, sitting in a chair and so on. And you know, I took some ibuprofen because it would seem very inflamed, and, you know, and I thought, you know, if I can just get it to, you know, drop down a bit. And then I wondered, does that just affect the symptom, or does it actually make it better? You know? And so I looked online, and there was somebody who said, you know, the pain is actually good because it's telling you what not to do. Like if I'm moving in a way and I'm feeling pain, that's my body saying, don't do that, right? And so how the pain, you know, that's why the Buddha said regret and remorse, which is a very particular family of pain, right, is actually a guardian. It guards our actions and brings our attention to what we need to notice, right? What if that wasn't there? And so in a way, we need that. And yes, it's a heavy burden to carry when it arrives, right? But what could we do if it wasn't there?
Well, what I want to ask you is, how do you feel about that? Not being able to sit the way you'd like to.
Well, you know, I... I'm here, okay. Right? I'm appreciating all of you who sit in chairs and the value of, thank goodness that I can sit in this chair. Thank goodness that I can sit in this chair.
I understand.
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
For all I know, I might be training for how I'll spend a significant portion of my practice life. Who knows what lies ahead?
So, Shanti, loving kindness meditation, I'm so glad that that's available. I'd heard about it years ago and I kind of experimented with it. And I think it's important to insight because you have to, it gives you maybe a way to get in touch with your heart center if you're not feeling that very strongly. Mm-hmm. And so a good way to work with your own emotions.
And why is that important in your own meditation in terms of going deeper towards your own insight? How does that help you?
Well, it helps me to look at what's there and maybe be able to stay closer to it or take care of it in some way.
Well, how do we meet that pain, which can be enormous, right? I mean, we arrive to practice, so many of us, most of us perhaps, because of our entanglement in that pain. Yeah. And trying all kinds of ways to meet it or deal with it or subdue it, overcome it, right? And so, but how else can we learn how to liberate ourselves within it as that pain, but within the pain, right? We can't do it abstractly. And how does getting in touch with your heart help you in terms of being of service to others?
Well, it softens me, I guess. It makes me not be as judgmental, maybe, and not as harsh. I'm not as apt to try to fix something right away, or I don't know. In a way, it helps me see things a little more clearly, even if I don't understand what's going on.
Yeah. It brings forth compassion. Yeah. Years ago, I read a book about a number of people, very significant people in history, who were sort of history makers, who were manic depressive. And it talked about how their mental state was a burden, but it also was part of why they were so excellent, because they were all leaders in times of extreme crisis. And so they were able, and it talked about how those same qualities don't do so well when there is no crisis, right? But one of the things it talked about was how, because they suffered so acutely and so personally, that they had a lot of empathy. They really felt compassion. And that's part of what made them good leaders, is that they knew what that was for people. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
And we see examples, recent examples, we might say, of when that's absent. that ability to know another's pain.
Shoshanshi, I find it very challenging to come up here and speak in front of the Sangha, but I think it's important for all of us to offer our practice to each other.
Thank you for that.
So we're trying to gain insight. We're looking everywhere for it. And isn't the Four Immeasurables an expression of insight?
How? How do you see that?
Because compassion is none of us being alone or different, all of us wanting happiness and to be free of anxiety, no one wanting to suffer.
You know, what comes to mind, you know, the ability of the mind to make connections, isn't that just the most wondrous thing? I mean, it can be a little bit of a curse, you know, when it doesn't stop. But what came to mind just as you spoke was, you know, having spent so many years working within our prison sanghas and meeting so many people, men primarily, who were in prison, and learning something about their lives, sometimes their crimes, and how they got there, and then knowing them as this person now, and seeing these, and hearing about the person they had been, and just sort of, you know, imagining and seeing these qualities in them, these beautiful, incredible qualities that came forth, that in a sense were allowed to because the conditions of their lives had changed. And, you know, the fact that it was prison, but not just prison, it was also the Sangha. It was Buddha Dharma. It was their practice that was allowing them to bring forth these natural qualities that they possess, that we possess. And it just really made me think a lot about how the conditions of our lives, how important that is. It's not a determining factor because, you know, people do amazing things in difficult conditions and people do not very much at all in really good conditions. But that sometimes when those conditions shift and we see these qualities just begin to blossom, right? And doesn't that just show us the importance of this codependency that we have, not just with people, but with everything? And just affirm that those qualities are all here. And that when we do that practice of the Four Immeasurables, we're just calling to them. We're not looking for them somewhere out here. We're calling to them, right? And when I encourage people who are very, you know, sort of mired in self-doubt and self-criticism and feeling insufficient to do it in the first person, may I. And sometimes people will come back and I'll say, how's that going? They say, you know, I haven't been doing it. And I say, why? And they say, I can't say those words, you know. And I say, you have to, because you can't. You're the one who needs it, right? And to know that those are all present within us, right? And so in that way, this practice is really just a most natural thing. It's just calling Ali Ali oxen free. What does that mean? But you know?
You're it.
It means all come in. All come home.
Yeah.
It's all here. May your life go well. There may be regional variations in that.
Thank you.
Sanchi. A few years ago, you brought the Metta Sutra into the Sangha, and I had never heard it before. And, you know, we chanted it a lot, and I incorporated it into my liturgy. And I just found it so striking. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. And then goes on with this instruction on what to do, how to not cause fear, and how to overcome, how to live into one's own fear. So my question is, how is it that prajna, wisdom, can exist without loving kindness?
I don't know. I've never seen that possibility.
Okay.
I've seen the illusion of it, the sense of it. You know, that's where our minds are so brilliant. But in their brilliance, sometimes without wisdom, that brilliance does not serve well too often. And so we can convince ourselves of all kinds of things. It's everywhere.
Even the Dharma.
And in the Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's why, you know, I've often thought, because as Hogen Sensei said, you know, I came really, you know, wanting to enlighten my mind, wanting to realize my self nature. And I thought if I can just do that, then everything else somehow, in my way of seeing things, which was knowing nothing, but not knowing how much I did not know, I thought it'll all just work out. And I wonder if I had come into a sangha or was studying with a teacher who didn't emphasize that non-duality between wisdom and compassion, who didn't emphasize the teachings of the precepts. I don't know how my path would have progressed. Would I have gotten to that point where I realized this was not working? I don't know. I can't know that. Right? But I think of how important that is that we, in seeking the Dharma, we find our way to that very thing which is going to help us, right? May your life go on.
Yes. Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanchi. So much is stirring in me after Sishin and sitting here watching this take place. And I was, couldn't help but think, you know, how much I love you. I really do. And I know it because you break my heart, man. And I know that you break my heart because it allows me to come alive. And always, often so moved. So there.
So there indeed. Well, it is your love that sustains me. There is no question about it. I experience that all the time. Not all the time, but... I'm not finished with what I'm saying. Of how if I'm feeling tired or, you know, dull or just not lively, that I know that if I come in and I sit with you, that I see you in Doksan, right? Or I prepare a talk, that I am given, that I receive the gift that I've been given to offer something, and with the deep hope that I can offer something that is of value, that heals whatever is holding me down a bit, and usually quickly. May your life go well.
Thank you.
You know, the thing we've been emphasizing this morning about the importance of cultivating compassion, this ancient teaching of loving kindness. from the Buddha who was a renunciate, who left his family, who was a very demanding person. I often wonder what would it be like to have actually sat in his presence, you know. And that he understood, he knew, right? He had seen within himself the importance of this, and no doubt also saw within his many decades of creating and cultivating and maintaining and nourishing a community of the importance of this, this teaching, this practice, this aspect of ourselves. And so in the same way that loving kindness and compassion is essential for our insight, the other is true too. That insight, our understanding, the development of our clarity is also essential to our compassion. And I think that's also very important to remember, because there are so many things that are calling to us today that need our attention and need our compassionate attention. And as practitioners in Buddha Dharma and in the West, there is a strong call within many sanghas, within our own sangha, to respond. And so we're doing that in various ways. And many practitioners are doing that in other ways. And there are people in the sangha who are making that really the basis of their livelihoods and their careers. And that's so compelling and so strong, and it's persistent, and it's always there. Every morning when you wake up, there it is. And no matter what you do, no matter how much you do, there's more. And because of that, there's that the call to that can call us away from the cushion, because it's so demanding, because the urgency, the fire is so hot. It can be, who has time to sit? Is that not even an indulgence? Shouldn't we all be out there? You know. And I think so that when we really, as practitioners, when we think about compassion, in our mind, they're really one word. Wisdom, it's one word. It's one thing. And sometimes we focus in this way, and sometimes we focus in this way. But to always be remembering, these arise together, right? They cannot actually be divided. And in that sense, each is calling to the other. So that if we do waver, if we do wander, right, and become too fixated on this side, that we are called, right, to bring that, in a sense, back into balance, back into a middle path. And that is a very, very profound thing. Thank goodness. Not only thank goodness for that is the Buddha's teaching, but thank goodness that's the way the world is. Thank goodness that that's what we are, right? And the affirmation of that is that when we practice in that way, you know it, it's true. You know that it's your nature, because you experience that felt sense of affirmation of something true, even in moments that are difficult. You know, and that's a thing that's difficult to explain, that even in a moment when you're struggling, but you're practicing it in a way that you know how, that there's something that you know is true and right in that. So, how fortunate we are to have this, found this Dharma, to be practicing and to be practicing that together. So thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.